a lot better that way. There we go. All right, I'm all set.
Perfect. So how would you define a massively open online course, first of all?
Well, it's online, and it's open. And by open, what I mean is that access to the course is open to anybody without any sort of subscription or tuition fees. That certainly characterized the massive open online courses that we've done in the past. It doesn't have to be massive, but it needs to have the potential of being massive. And what that means is that the way the course is designed can't really have any bottlenecks in it. I'll give you an example of a bottleneck would be you know, your traditional discussion forum, your traditional threaded discussion, which works really well with 20 people, 100 people, doesn't work that well with 100,000. So the idea that it could be massive is intended in the design of the course. And the way we've approached this is that we've supported massiveness through decentralization. What that means is that people use their own applications, their own blogging software, for example, to contribute to the course. We use mechanisms such as RSS aggregators to provide structure for the course. And we support large numbers of people by not having any centralized location here. So typically, a massive open online course will also be a decentralized course, although I know in actual usage of the word, there have been exceptions to that.
Okay. And are there different types of MOOCs?
Well, I guess clearly there are. The original MOOCs that people like George Siemens and I created starting 4 years ago have come to be known as connectivist MOOCs. These are MOOCs that are structured in the form of a network and are explicitly distributed, as I've mentioned. The MOOCs that were offered by Stanford, Brun, and I've forgotten their names, are what might be, I call them ex-MOOCs. And basically, they're MOOCs that support large numbers through automation. So they put some content onto a single website and then have people go through that content, perform exercises which are graded automatically, and conduct their discussions in their own ways. And they may also have online synchronous or video presentations of the material. I think these are two different approaches. One of them is more clearly centralized than the other. One of them is more clearly content-based than the other. One of them is more clearly based on machine-gradable assignments than the other.
Okay. So how do environments like Gatsby, edX, Coursera compare?
With each other?
Yes.
I couldn't begin to answer that question.
Okay. Alright,
I wasn't sure if you did
or not,
so
that's fine. So what's the significance of 12 more universities offering courses through Udacity?
Sorry, say that again, please.
Sure. What's the significance of 12 more
universities,
now a total of
15,
plus
offering
courses through
Udacity? Well, the immediate significance is they've suddenly got a lot more publicity for their initiative, which when you're a commercial initiative is everything, right? Need your publicity. And, just coming out of Stanford and MIT in the first place, they automatically generate a lot of publicity just by that fact. And now, with a number of other universities signing on, whatever that means, we're not sure what that means yet, that generates that much more publicity. I'm not sure that it will have any particular impact in the courses that are offered. I don't see any of the universities changing what they do for the mainstream of their own population. To me, it sounds mostly like a branding exercise and may involve contributions from these university staff. But other than that, I don't see a big difference happening in what they're doing.
Okay. So how long term, how does offering these types of courses benefit universities and benefit participants?
Well, it's not clear it'll benefit universities yet.
Okay.
The connectivist style courses that we offered worked really well to support what the universities were up to, because we would have a core membership that signed up for an actual course, and then that course itself was thrown open to everybody. So what it did is it made the courses offered by the university more attractive. It created a whole new base of resources for these courses. It made them better courses, and not to mention advertise these courses to some degree. The courses, as I understand it, now, you know, my understanding may always be wrong, but as I understand it, the courses being offered by Coursera and Udemy and the rest aren't actual, real, live Stanford or MIT courses. So they're not going to benefit them in that way. I think in both cases, they benefit the participants, because like OpenCourseWare before, it was a way of getting access to learning that didn't exist before. And a lot of people, most people in the world, can't access the resources of a Stanford or an MIT or even a University of Manitoba or University of Alberta or Athabasca, because there's cost, there's time, there's all kinds of other considerations. And this throws that open. This allows people to take part in university-level education with real university material, real university people, and real university professors, essentially for free. Or at least in some of these commercial models, for very low cost. And of course, what they're trying to do is commercialize this so that what we're offering free, they'll sell for whatever, $24.95 or whatever. But it, even at that cost, it greatly opens the access. And I think this can't help but be helpful to people. Helpful to people intending to attend university sometime in the future, wanting to get a bit ahead on the content. Helpful for people just looking for that knowledge. You know, I do a lot of programming. I'm not going to stop my job and take a programming course, but something like this is really helpful. I just go in and you know, brush up on some of my programming, pick up a new language or something like that. Really helpful. So it makes things cheaper, easier, and more accessible, and that's a huge impact to learners. It's a huge challenge to universities, and there, you know, I think there's no question about it, and that's why there was this whole foofra over the president of, what was it, Virginia, who was fired and then rehired, because it's clear now, in a way that it wasn't before, that universities can't just keep doing what they're doing and hope this whole online thing goes away. It's not only not going to go away, it's definitely going to change how universities offer their offerings and change it in a big way.
Okay. And what does that change look like,
I think, in the future for them? I think the big thing is that it opens it up. And let me be precise about that, because that's more fun. The content is the first thing that got opened up. And it's still not completely opened up, but it's pretty much open up. And now you can go online and read about statistics or artificial intelligence or geology or heart surgery or whatever you want. It's all there. But of course, an education consists of more than just exposure to the content. And that's a really important thing. One of the things that universities provided in addition to exposure to this content was some sort of, there's two aspects here. The first part of that aspect is, you know, practice or activity involving that content or involving that domain. And then secondly, and equally vitally important, immersion into a community of practitioners related to that content. So take medicine, for example, right? You want to study medicine. First thing to study in medicine is you read a bunch of medical texts, or Grey's Anatomy, whatever. But that's just, you're just getting your book learning, right? But to become a doctor, not only do you have to actually get in there and practice doctoring, which means diagnosing, it means slicing and dicing, and flaking and forming, and whatever doctors do, but it also means being in a hospital, working with other people in a hospital, working with nurses, working with practitioners, interacting with patients, being in that community. These two things, the activity and the immersion, are vitally important in any discipline. You need them both. And that's what universities have traditionally offered. They bring you in, give you a bunch of books to study from, but they get you working in the discipline, and most of all, they immerse you into a community of people who will eventually be your peers. The good universities do this really well. It has nothing to do with the quality of the teaching or anything like that. It's the social aspect that they're really strong on. The Yale, the MIT, etc. They build these networks that are legendary in stature. Now, that's what's being opened up. The first thing that's opened up, and this is what Udemy and Coursera and the rest open up, are the activity bits. So, and some of the activity is participation in a class, although that's like a lecture, so you just sit and watch. The other part is working on problems, right? And you might even work on problems with other people, but the main thing that they're providing is the activity. The main thing that the connectivist courses offer is the immersion into community. And we emphasized that largely because there aren't really good activities associated with the disciplines that we've worked on, although it's been a subject of discussion between George and Dave and myself. What are the activities we can get people to do? But the key here is the immersion into the community, creating the dialogue, and all of that. That's what's being opened up now. So your typical university course in the future, you've got the people who are signed up at the university, and they're signed up, we almost don't know why they're signed up, but there will always be, if you will, something like a value plus option for people to sign up. Maybe it's the on-campus experience that they're signing up for. Certainly it's a big part of what universities offer, the in-person connection with professors, whatever. It may just be the certification. Certainly the value proposition to signing up for a university course is going to change in reaction to all of this. But you have your core. These people are doing their course, but now they're doing their course in conjunction with 1,000, 10,000, whatever, other people also doing the same course. Some of them may be signed up with other universities. And this is something I don't think they've really thought through yet, right? You don't need to have a separate intro stats course at every single university. You have different cohorts signed up at different universities, but they can all participate in the same online massive course experience. And what that's doing now is taking all of these, students from here, students from there, students who are not associated with any particular university, and putting them all into this large community where they start interacting on an intro stats type level. So this is the picture now. You've got the core groups at the universities. You got the other groups kind of hanging on, watching, participating, interacting. These people may be people looking for a refresher, people looking to, get ahead and prepare for eventual enrollment in one of these actual universities, etc. But it's all been opened up, so you can see all of this interaction back and forth. And it's really a different picture of what it's like to learn a subject. We have this traditional thinking that, we have a class, it's closed, it's rolls. And it's separate from everything else. The more and more the class is open, it doesn't have walls, and it becomes more and more a part of the actual practice and the discipline that it's involved in. So you can imagine that, maybe I'll pick a different example, geography. You can imagine a geography MOOC involving geography students from different universities, involving the general public. They all do these geography activities, whatever they are. It's distributed, so you know, we're not all trying to flood one single website, but it becomes this distributed community. And then layered on top of that is the actual interaction with actual geographers who are using this course as a way of doing their job, or as part of doing their job, are contributing to this course. So we can picture courses set up around specific geographical exercises. Oh, we're going to map the back 40. Okay, well, let's make a course out of that. As we map the back 40, these 1,000 people can follow along. So we begin to see a lot of the traditional boundaries between learning and work, learning and recreation, etc., begin to disappear. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Okay. So, you kind of mentioned some benefits to the university earlier, but how can you sustain this long term?
Well, it depends on the model you're working from. In different jurisdictions, universities offer their courses, tuition free. They get their funding from government, and this approach lowers the overall cost of providing university education to a society, and that's how you sustain it. You're saving money. In models where universities are private enterprises and exist to make money, the challenge is much more significant. Generally, when a product with restricted availability has become more widely available, the way you sustain your business model is you lower your price and you go for max, which is, of course, the core of the Coursera Udemy-type model, right? They're dropping the cost of an individual course to 10% of what it used to be and going for an audience that will be more than 10 times what they could originally get in one of these classes. And it's a good model. It does work. And we've seen in other domains where when you drop the price by that, to that 10% of the original, you certainly do make it up in sales. In Canada, it's kind of a mixed model where we have tuition pays, I forget the exact percentage, but it varies between 25% and 40% of the cost. Government pays a similar or slightly higher percentage, and then other sources pay for the rest. So this approach can ease the pressures on tuition. It also eases the pressures on government funding for our institutions. And because everybody's saving, that's how it becomes sustainable.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to add that you think I should know, or that
I'll try to know? The main thing is not to freak out because of these new courses. These guys are where we were in 2008, and they're making some of the same mistakes. They'll learn from them a lot more quickly. They will move to a more distributed model because they have to. But the way it should go is to do it by encouraging people to distribute the materials and the events around these courses. I was going somewhere with that. It's going to be very difficult for universities to adjust, but it's going to be so much better for students, and there will be more market and more employment in this field eventually as a result of this. So people shouldn't freak out and worry about losing their jobs. You know, when you educate all of society instead of 10% of it, there's a lot more jobs in education.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
And how should I identify you in the article?
Stephen Downs.
Okay, but as far as title or description of what you do?
I'm a researcher. I'm a researcher at the National Research Council of Canada.
And you've taught a number of courses, and you're also
yes.
Work with the other guys on campus.
That's correct.
Well, thank you so much again, and I will make sure you get a link when the story goes up. It should be up hopefully later today or tomorrow.
So. Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
And you don't mind me posting this audio recording online?
No, that's fine.
Excellent. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye.